It's the Week in Review. Good morning. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we'll look back at the top headlines in politics with a couple of guests. From gay marriage in Wisconsin to the latest on some of the names we'll be seeing on the election ballots this year. We invite you to join the conversation with your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. My guests today are Ed Filone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University, and Margaret Farrow, former Republican Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin and former state lawmaker. She's also a member of the UW System Board of Regents. Ed Filone, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
And Margaret Farrow, thank you for being here once again.
Well, pleasure to be here. Good morning.
So U.S. District Judge Barbara Crabb is scheduled to hear arguments this afternoon on what she should order state officials to do next about gay marriages. The ACLU says the state should allow gay couples to marry and recognize out-of-state gay marriages. Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen says that request is too broad. He also wants Crabb to put her ruling on hold pending his planned appeal. If that happens, gay marriages would be stopped for now, at least. Ed Filone, what should Judge Crabb instruct state officials to do?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a misconception that this is Judge Crabb's complete decision. I think in a case like this, judges have proposed orders that are put forth by the parties in the case. The lawyers in the case put forth a proposed order and make the arguments why the judge should sign their order. And so, the ACLU has asked for an order where Judge Crabb would instruct state officials to process and recognize the marriages that have been entered into. And obviously, Attorney General Van Hollen has asked for a stay on her ruling where she would put everything in suspended animation from this point forward until an appeal can be brought to the Seventh Circuit. What typically has been happening in these same-sex marriage cases is laws have been ruled unconstitutional at the district court level, predominantly, and usually the district court judges have issued stays to let the appellate courts take it up. And so I would imagine this will probably follow that same pattern.
Margaret Farrow?
Well, I guess Judge Crabb a week ago kind of created this situation that we're in now by, and I'm not a lawyer, let me make it clear, and I know Ed, I defer to Ed with a lot of his knowledge, but in being resourceful and reading, I understand that Judge Crabb did not give any direction as to the status of these possible marriages that could take place until she completed with the attorneys on both sides the rest of the story. We only got a partial part of the story last week when she said this is unconstitutional, and now we still have to hear her direction as to what should be done about it. This has been a very hectic legally and emotionally a hectic week because of her incomplete ruling. Many judges, as I understand it, at the time they make the decision she did last week, also give the direction she is apparently going to give today. So it's unfortunate there's been this much upheaval, let's say, in the status of things, but hopefully today it'll be in some way calmed down.
Why do you suppose... Ed, I'll let you respond to this question. Why do you suppose it was an incomplete, or what some are calling an incomplete ruling, where not much direction was given as to what to do?
Well, it was not an incomplete ruling. It's being criticized by people who want to somehow blame the judge for the situation, which I think is typical politicization of the process here. It's actually a very thoughtful, complete ruling. Her analysis of the equal protection arguments, her analysis of the due process arguments under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. It's a very well-written, well-reasoned opinion. And so I'm always disappointed when people who don't like a particular court ruling try to somehow attack the judge. A few years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court decided the Windsor case, striking down as unconstitutional the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. And Justice Scalia dissented from that decision. He said that the reasoning of the majority of the U.S. Supreme Court would eventually be used to strike down state laws prohibiting same-sex marriage. And in fact, since the Windsor case, that's exactly what's happened. And district courts around the country have been following that same line of reasoning, oftentimes citing Justice Scalia in support of their conclusions. So there's nothing unusual in how Judge Crabb ruled. What we're all waiting for is to see how the federal circuit courts, courts of appeals, treat the issue here.
Our phone number, if you want to join our conversation, is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. What are your thoughts and questions and reactions to some of the developments here with regards to same-sex marriage in the state of Wisconsin? You can call in or send them along to our email address, which is talk@wpr.org. It's the Week in Review with my guests Ed Filone and Margaret Farrow. Van Hollen said yesterday that clerks who are issuing marriage licenses to gay couples could face charges from local district attorneys for breaking the law. So far, 60 of Wisconsin's 72 counties are handing out marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Margaret, should these clerks be charged for issuing these licenses?
Who are you asking?
I'm sorry. You.
My phone, someone had tried to get in, and I had that little... it took the message away for a moment. I guess that whole issue, again, could have been this entire clerk issue could have been avoided if Judge Crabb had taken the full action. I understand her decision and her opinion was complete and well-written, as Ed Filone just said, but she did not give direction as to what people should do. And those couples waiting to be married, sprang into action, as one can understand. And there was no direction given as to the status of things in general legally. So I think it's unfortunate. We do have 72 duly elected clerks in our 72 counties, and they did not get the direction as to what to do. And I think if you follow the letter of the law, and that is what I have to assume J.B. Van Hollen, the Attorney General, was doing, they should wait until we find out if there will be a stay granted for her decision taking place, or if it's wide open right now. And I think J.B. Van Hollen was expressing the concern of, if you believe in the law, then let's wait till the law is given, fulfills what we are looking for as to an answer. And we didn't get that yet, and many are very hopeful that this afternoon there will be that clarity.
Well, this case has been pending for quite some time, so I'm a little surprised that apparently no one in the state government thought to anticipate an adverse ruling and what would happen and give instructions to their clerks on how to proceed. So if anyone is caught flat-footed, I'm not going to blame Judge Crabb for that. But I do think that, this is has been a movement in the federal courts over the last couple years. We've seen several state laws banning same-sex marriage struck down as unconstitutional, and in every instance, individuals have immediately gone and exercised their right to marry as a result of the ruling, and then a stay will get issued, and everything will stop and pending an appeal. So nothing unusual is happening in Wisconsin at all. This is exactly what you would expect to see, and I think any threats to prosecute clerks really are pointless. Any attempted prosecution, the clerk would simply say, I had a good faith belief that as a result of the judge's ruling, I could not prevent these people from getting married. End of story. So it would be a total waste of time and money for any district attorney to follow up on Van Hollen's suggestion here.
Governor Walker said yesterday that his personal opposition to same-sex marriage doesn't matter because the ban on gay marriage was put into the state constitution by the vote of the people. He was asked about the judge's decision, and he dodged questions about it, about his position, saying that my position has been clear. I voted in the past. It really doesn't matter. Ed, do you think it does matter where the governor still stands on same-sex marriage today?
Well, I think obviously he's in the middle of a very tight reelection campaign, and he does not want to alienate a very growing, politically active lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community in Wisconsin. I mean, we've seen that community is very willing to go public and to donate money to candidates who support same-sex marriage rights, and all of a sudden Governor Walker is not going to, you know, energize them into opposing him in a tight race. I think that's entirely understandable and consistent with his practice to sort of try not to provoke opposition to his policies.
Margaret Farrow, what do you think? Should his should he be more open about his position on the matter?
Well, I think he was very candid in reminding people that he has, I have a frog. I think he's very candid in reminding people of what his position is and what it has been, historically, and what he's voted even as a legislator. And I think the frustration people have at this point is, what does my opinion count? I voted. Many people are saying, I voted in 2006. 60% of the state of Wisconsin expressed their concern that we preserve the historic and traditional definition of marriage. And we're finding that the laws that do not take into in analysis in the legal arena of the courtroom, personal opinion and general public opinion does not hold sway, that instead it is the interpretation of, I believe it's the 14th Amendment, and of the U.S. Constitution. So individual opinions right now do not have a direct impact, I don't believe, and I don't blame the governor at all for stating things as he did yesterday.
Is it important for him, though, to make a statement either way, though, on this election cycle?
Well, I think, that was for Margaret.
Okay. I think that time will come. I think we're probably going to experience several debates down the road. We're still 5 months from the election. There's still an awful lot of things to happen on this issue and many issues. And I think when we see those debates, we'll have clear enough reaction to them that people will understand where both candidates are.
Well, Governor Walker has always been a bit of a shapeshifter in terms of his positions, his principles. I'm recalling his approach to the question of stem cell medical research and his refusal to give a straight answer on whether he supported or opposed that form of medical research. He's the consummate politician who has his finger to the wind, and he may not have realized the shift in public mood in favor of equal rights in marriage, and he may have been slow in recognizing that the sands have shifted under his feet, but now he clearly sees that, and so he's going to start backpedaling. I think that would be consistent with his past practice.
And I want to mention, we do have an invitation to Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen to join us on the State Capitol Report on Monday morning. We're hoping he can join us, but you'll want to stay tuned for more information on that. This is The Week in Review. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. And our guests this week are Ed Falone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University, and Margaret Farrow, a former Republican Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin and a former state lawmaker. We're taking your questions as well and your comments on the top headlines of this week at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Cynthia Schuster on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rounding up the week's top headlines on The Week in Review, I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guests this hour are Ed Falone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University, and Margaret Farrow, former Republican Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin and former state lawmaker. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Before the break, we were talking about gay marriage, and Mary Burke applauded last week's ruling by Judge Crabb. Ed Falone, how big an issue do you see gay marriage being in the governor's race this fall?
Well, I think it could be an issue. We've got as everyone knows, we've got a toss-up here in the governor's race, which is a bit surprising, considering that Scott Walker already ran and won two elections in the last 4 years, but he's now finds himself in a toss-up. And so there's a very small segment of our state population who has not already made up its mind. And this issue of same-sex marriage rights can be an issue that energizes people, inspires people who otherwise would not take an interest in the race to get interested and to get involved, and so it can be one of those focal points that might make the difference. And I think the Burke campaign clearly wants to draw sharp contrast between itself and Governor Walker on the issue, and we'll see if Governor Walker is going to agree to that contrast or whether he's going to try and muddy the waters a bit on it.
And Margaret, what do you think?
I think that there are going to be a number of very key issues in this race, but I would absolutely agree with Ed that most people have already decided who their candidate is. I think it's a very interesting time in Wisconsin politics, and I think there's going to be a lot of interesting campaigning that's going to go on. I think we're all kind of waiting with a little bit of dread for the commercials to start, mm-hmm. and the lack of control over them and their content makes one shudder. But I think that this will probably be there. Will it be one of the front and center issues? No. It will be an issue, and it will be something that proponents of gay marriage will be pushing hard, and those who are supporting traditional marriage will be kind of meeting them in the middle somewhere there to kind of hold true to their positions. I think polling is telling us something about this race right now, but it's I often want to know who is being asked and what are the actual questions. And in the case of the polling and the closeness, it isn't quite as close when you begin to ask questions of those who also say they are going to vote and intend to vote in November. There's more separation between the candidates in favor of Walker and that type of a countdown of numbers.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Keith in Beaver Dam. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Yes, I was kind of wondering what the laws were that if this defensive marriage law wouldn't have came in effect. What laws are on the books? Did that eliminate some other laws or strengthen them? Or, I mean, obviously right now, I mean, what happens to, are there Wisconsin laws that talk outlaw polygamy, other forms of marriage?
Thanks, Keith. What did the laws say before the marriage amendment was put into effect? I guess I'll toss it to Ed first.
Well, the state statutes define who can get married, and if I recall correctly, before the Constitution of the state of Wisconsin was amended, the statutes did specify a man and a woman. You had to have opposite genders, if I recall correctly. What the constitutional amendment in our state did was it tried to elevate to a matter of state constitutional law the prohibition on same-sex marriage, and that would make it impossible to simply draft a different statute, so make it legislatively more difficult to institute same-sex marriage and requiring a court ruling to do it. And so that was the intent behind the 2006 amendment of the Constitution, which I hope people recall was incredibly confusingly worded and was not written so that the voters really understood clearly what the issues were. So this is fairly consistent. It doesn't, the court's ruling merely applies to same-sex marriage. It doesn't have any broader applicability to things like polygamy or any other non-traditional form of marriage. It's solely gender and sex related for one couple. And people who somehow are concerned or upset that you have a legislative action that's overturned by the courts under a challenge of constitutional rights, you can't applaud Judge Randa for applying the First Amendment to strike down campaign finance laws and then criticize Judge Crabb for applying the 14th Amendment to strike down a ban on same-sex marriage. It's just the role of the federal courts to apply constitutional protections and to strike down inconsistent laws, and you can't be selective about when you like it and when you don't. It's just part of the system.
Margaret, did you want to add any information?
Yeah, I do want to comment on that because this wasn't a legislative action. Certainly it involved the legislature, but it's striking down an action of 60% of the people, and I think if there was confusion, as you're claiming, and I don't think there was, in the ballot language, it was because of the way we have to write them to please the lawyers, the legalese that are always involved in ballot questions on referenda constantly have have to be almost translated because of the legalese in which they have to be written. I think the thing that has a lot of us disturbed is that 60% of the people, far more than a simple majority, spoke on this issue. And I think that the fact that it can now be overturned in the tide of what is a public sentiment and a representation of so many people's concern, and I question those numbers. I mean, in all of this hoopla, we've had about 500-some marriage licenses in these 60 or more counties that have been issued in the time. I don't think that, and that's some people, and I legitimately heard some people's reference in news stories that they have been waiting 8 and 10 years to be able to do this. So this is a pent-up need that we're seeing that these numbers represent in terms of that part of the population of the state. So I think that many of us are upset that it was a constitutional amendment, which takes far more than just legislative action. And I guess my question is, if this is being thrown out on the basis of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, why can't polygamy be approved on that same basis of denying those people their right to fair treatment under the law? And I think that's where perhaps the caller was getting at. When you negate a law, the previous law takes effect, as I understand it. He wanted to know what the previous law was. Mm-hmm. We had a marriage registry under Governor Doyle's time in the legislature, and that I'm trying to remember, Ed, maybe you remember what the courts did when they were challenged on that. But my question is legitimate because I've had it posed by many people talking about this. What about polygamy and the 14th Amendment?
Well, you know, the United States Constitution commands equal treatment under the law for all people. And the burden is not on the people to justify equal treatment. The burden is on the government if they attempt to treat people unequally. And so the burden is not on supporters of same-sex marriage to explain why polygamy wouldn't be allowed or why any other horror story isn't allowed. The burden's on the state to justify why should same-sex marriages be treated differently. And the reason why the district court judges are ruling in favor of the plaintiffs in these cases is because the state cannot come up with any reason why a same-sex couple committed, living together, in many cases, like it was in Wisconsin, able to register and get some benefits that married couples get, the state cannot come up with any rational reason why they shouldn't get the full benefits of marriage. And until the states can come up with a reason, the command of the 14th Amendment is they deserve equal treatment.
This is The Week in Review. I'm Cynthia Schuster, sitting in for Joy Cardine this week, and our guests are Ed Falone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University, and Margaret Farrow, a former Republican Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin and a former state lawmaker. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Mary Burke says Governor Walker has failed the state and that Wisconsin needs a new direction. She made the remarks at last weekend's Democratic Party convention. Burke says Walker's been taking a divide-and-conquer approach. The Walker campaign insists the state is better off than it was 4 years ago and that Burke would take the state backward. Margaret Farrow, what direction do you think the state is going?
I think the state's in great shape, and I think it's moving in a very strong direction. The naysayers will immediately say, well, we didn't get to the 250,000 jobs that Governor Walker made a commitment to work toward at the beginning of this and during his last campaign. No, we didn't. And did anyone expect the national recession to last as long as it has and to be the slowest in recovery in the history of this country? There is no question that we were going upstream against a tide that was very, very difficult. And at the same time, we are moving in that direction and well on the way to that type of success. But primarily, we have to look at our small businesses, where the jobs are. Are they coming into existence? Yes, at a higher rate than ever. We're seeing small businesses start up, and we're seeing a number of activities along that line to measure it by. Is our tax situation better? Yes. Our balance of, using a cliche, our balance of payments, we are getting enough in to pay our needs in the state of Wisconsin to the extent that we had surpluses after we had come from a strong and very negative debt situation that we were in the end of the Doyle administration era. We had lost hundreds of thousands of jobs. We were in very deep debt with our balance that was not in the Treasury, and we've now just completely flipped that. We have young people coming out of our schools, ready to work and finding jobs, and small businesses starting up. I think that there's a lot to be done in the state yet. I think Governor Walker is speaking to that in his campaign, but anyone who says Wisconsin is not in a better place after these 4 years, almost 4 years, is hiding somewhere in the closet, not looking at reality.
And Fallone, what direction do you think Mary Burke should take the state in?
Well, you know, she shouldn't do what the Walker administration has done, which is try and cite irrelevant factors like small business creation, which has nothing to do with job growth or job creation, because many of these small businesses, as Margaret knows, are merely, you know, one-person incorporated consulting businesses by someone who got laid off from their regular job. Very, very little correlation between the formation of these new businesses. Many of them are nonprofits that get included in this statistic that aren't having any employees. So it's really just a bit of a diversionary tactic to throw some statistics around and pretend you've got growth. The reality is Wisconsin has come back from the 2008 recession slower than other Midwestern states and slower than one would expect. And so you've got two different stories here. The Walker administration saying the reason we're bouncing back more slowly is not our fault in trying to divert attention. And the Burke administration saying, well, maybe if you hadn't attacked the public employee unions, if you hadn't have dampened the spending, consumer spending, in the first year of your administration, we would have had the same sort of steep recovery that we're seeing in our neighboring states. And so it was actually your own policies that contributed to the slower recovery than expected. So it's a tough story. You know, you know, Walker can claim some recovery, and the Democrats and Mary Burke can say yes, but not as strong as it should have been. And it's a little bit of a interesting competing stories that we're going to see in this campaign, and we're going to see which story is most compelling to the voters.
Well, before Mary Burke can hop in the driver's seat and challenge Governor Walker in the elections, she has to get past State Representative Brett Halsey in a Democratic primary. The Government Accountability Board allowed him on the ballot despite challenges to his nomination signatures. Ed, how big a challenge can Halsey mount against Burke this August?
Well, zero, because he has no money and no prospect of getting money, and therefore he won't be on television across the state. He may not be on television at all, and if you can't get on TV, you have zero chance of winning. I think that Halsey being on the ticket is a bit of a blessing and a curse for the Burke campaign. On the one hand, he can be the attack dog, go after Scott Walker, make, you know, very aggressive charges, trying to put the Walker administration in a bad light, and to the extent he does that, Mary Burke doesn't have to get her hands dirty. On the other hand, he is certainly demonstrated in his career, his political career, that he is unpredictable, and one never knows how far he's going to go or if he's going to go too far. And so the Republicans will try to argue that Halsey is the face of the Democratic Party, and any slip-up or embarrassment he makes, they'll try to tarnish Mary Burke with. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. She might prefer not to have him in the race, but on the other hand, it's possible that it might work to her advantage slightly.
And Margaret, what will Brett Halsey's presence in the Democratic primary do for the party?
Well, I think the party's going to have a challenge there. I think they had tried to keep everyone out, and they did keep people out who were legitimate seekers of a role and a place in the ballot on the primary. There are a number of other very legitimate Democrat potential candidates who were discouraged and were given probably very good reasons why it was in their best interest not to get into the middle of this. And the anointed candidate was Mary Burke. There's no question about it. Brett Halsey is an unpredictable person. They're going to be challenged as to will they debate him, and if not, what does that show the Democratic Party really represents if they don't want to hear several different sides within their own side of the aisle? deliberations on this. So they're going to be kind of called to task in ways they have so enjoyed doing when the Republicans have had primaries and they have not. So I think he can cause some heartburn. I agree that I think he has a very slim chance of getting any sizable amount of votes because people across the state won't know who he is, and it's going to be difficult. But I think they certainly would much prefer not to have him on the scene at all.
Well, we talked to a political scientist yesterday about the House race in Virginia, in which Eric Cantor had lost to a Tea Party candidate that some are surprised to see that he won. But the political scientist credits the grassroots effort of the candidate, David Bratt. And you may not be able to compare a House seat with a governor's race, but I'm wondering if Brett Halsey, if he does enough grassroots campaigning, despite the low finances that he has in comparison to the other candidates, if he might have more success than you actually predict. And I'll toss that to Ed Falone first.
No, I don't think so at all. I don't think you can make that comparison because a House race, you've got a relatively small district, a small number of voters. Mm-hmm. That you're trying to reach a statewide race, far more voters. An insurgent grassroots campaign at the state level would be extremely difficult. And also in the Eric Cantor situation, he was an incumbent, and there's always that anti-incumbent fervor that can be whipped up. People who are unsatisfied with the incumbent might be inspired to vote for an unknown quantity under the theory of, well, at least they're better than what I've got. That's not going to apply here in the Burke campaign. She's not an incumbent, and so you're not going to have that anti-incumbent vote to play off of. So I really don't think it would translate to Halsey's favor. Winning a statewide race is incredibly difficult. I know because I lost one a year ago. And it's just you need to have the money. You need to have the support of the party behind you. And it'd be almost impossible, in my view, for Halsey to pull this off.
Would you agree, Margaret?
To some extent, I would agree, and I think also you have to look at the quality of the candidates. Apparently, Professor Bratt in Virginia was quite engaging and quite articulate and did work very hard at the grassroots level, and people apparently believed him. And I think there was one huge lacking that Eric Cantor had slipped into, and that was his lacking of being close to his district. If there's one thing the voters want and constituents want, is to sense that they can reach out and touch their lawmaker at any level, and that sometimes is figurative. In other words, if they call their congressman or the governor's office, will someone listen? Even if they can't get hold of the office holder at beck and call, they have to feel they care. And I think, unfortunately, because of his dedication to the national scene and to the national needs and to the caucus as a whole in the House of Representatives, Eric Cantor apparently forgot that or overlooked that. And so I think the quality of the candidate's important, and I think that Brett Halsey is not a Professor Bratt, I don't think.
And we'll get back into the Virginia race in just a little bit. But first, I wanted to focus on another race here in the state. Former state senator and convicted felon Gary George will be allowed to take on Congresswoman Gwen Moore this fall. Margaret, what's Gary George up to here? Does he still have a legitimate shot at heading to Washington?
Well, I know Gary George. I've served with Gary George, and I guess my reaction—you asked the question I asked myself when I saw the initial news that he was going to be running and that he had filed the necessary nomination papers, and now the GAB has approved his presence on the ballot. My only reaction is Gary George is one of the smartest people I met in my tenure in Madison. I have about a handful that I could put in that category, and he is very intelligent, very strategically adept, and he wouldn't be doing this if he didn't think he had a chance. What he's doing it for, I don't know. What is motivation? Does he have some policy issues he wants to work on? Is this something else? I don't know. Prior to his the conduct that ended him ended up getting him in prison for a while, I Well, I was under the impression he could have attained anything he went after in this state because he was a very intelligent, kind of going back to the previous conversation, very appealing candidate, had a level of sincerity people tended to trust, and then unfortunately he kind of dashed that in the behavior he was tried and convicted of. So I don't know. He wouldn't be doing this if he didn't think he had a chance, I think, no, mm-hmm. based on my prior knowledge.
And Ed Falone, does he have a chance?
Well, I'm going to be watching carefully to see if the Republicans start writing big checks to Gary George. And I think that, you know, in my opinion, the Republicans have viewed Gwen Moore as somewhat vulnerable if they could find the right challenger. She has a lot of support in her district, is well-liked, but she does not typically raise a lot of money. And I think Gary George, if the Republicans start donating large sums to him and he can really get his face out there and get his, some sort of a message out there, he is the kind of candidate who could cause Gwen Moore some trouble. And so I'm going to watch and see if his donations trend heavily Republican, and we'll see what happens in this race.
Well, we're talking with Ed Falone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University, and Margaret Farrow, former Republican Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin and a former state lawmaker. It's the Week in Review here on the Ideas Network. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine, and we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. It's our own Week in Review here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine, and we're talking with Ed Falone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University, and Margaret Farrow, former Republican Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin and former state lawmaker. But before we get back to the news, it's time for a Week in Review quiz. The Food and Drug Administration cheesed off a lot of Wisconsin cheesemakers this week. Before reversing its decision, what did the FDA say that cheesemakers could no longer use to age cheese? You can submit your answers at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email them in at talk@wpr.org. You have about 5 minutes to get your guesses in, and then we'll pick a random winner out of all the correct answers. So call now or send an email. We'll reveal the answer later in the show. Let's see. Let's pick up the conversation by talking about immigration here. With Eric Cantor's loss to Dave Brat this week in Virginia, President Obama says he rejects the notion that Cantor's defeat means immigration reform is dead. What's your take, Ed Falone?
Immigration reform is dead.
Okay.
It was barely on life reform on life support as it was. You know, the issue of immigration is an issue which you know, policymakers recognize that immigration is vital to the economic growth of our country. It's vital to keeping our median population age from creeping up ever higher and turning us into a nation of elderly any faster than we already are. The current system right now is not geared up to let in the kinds of immigrants that we really need to grow our economy. It's too much delay. And so reform is way overdue. But unfortunately, it's a very emotional issue, and it can be demagogued, and it was very successfully demagogued in the Eric Cantor race in Virginia. Until the Republicans stop using it as an issue to whip up their base, it's going to be extremely difficult for them to make the compromises necessary to pass federal legislation here. So if it wasn't already dead, I think Cantor's loss sends a message to other congresspeople that they risk challenges in their districts if they support reform, and I think it's probably dead now.
Do you agree, Margaret?
Well, I think it's probably dead for this term. There was, I think, a lot of interest or perhaps focus on maybe doing something between the November elections and the January swearing-in of the new Congress, because there is that lame duck period during which issues like this often, with the lame duck members, voting with a bit more freedom, let's say, than they had, that could have happened. And there was real effort, I think, to think in terms of it, some level of it happening. But I guess there was a time when the Obama administration, for the first 2 years, had everything. They had both houses and the White House, and they did nothing on immigration. It has been a very difficult issue for going back historically through the various administrations prior to this one. They haven't dealt with it. Ed is right in that this country is a country built on immigration. We have laws dealing with immigration. Those laws do need some fine-tuning, but I guess when we say that globally, we're overlooking what is the largest problem right now, and that is our border with Mexico. If Americans did what is happening from our direction into Mexico with what is happening with Mexican citizens coming into this country, just begin to imagine the furor that would be caused by it. And I think this last demonstration of the children being brought in, and then I guess understandably they think the families will be allowed to follow or the children will be cared for, is putting a huge drain on the economies of both the states involved and the federal government, has a lot of bills to pay right now. And I just think that we have to deal with it. I think we have to deal with it as many have tried, and that is to begin to seal the borders. You can't come in any of the other borders without being checked. This one is right now is not being controlled at all, where so much pressure is on it. We have to address the immigration issues. We have to, first of all, close that border and allow the people to come in legally who are authorized to come in legally, and while we're addressing the change in laws.
Well, Eric Cantor said he'll resign as House Majority Leader at the end of July. Majority Whip Kevin McCarthy of California appears to be the front runner to take over as Majority Leader. Is this changing of the guard going to have any significant impact on anything, Margaret?
Well, I think it's too soon to know. I think there will be a number of new members come in. It's interesting here in the state what normally would happen in that kind of a situation is there'd either be a retention of the original person, as with Mike Ellis, who has announced retirement, and he's staying on as president of the Senate in the interim. Granted, he wasn't defeated, but I think they again have to pick their leadership as they come in, but I know it's much more cut and dried in Washington than it is here at the beginning of a session where it truly is an election. And I don't think anyone, perhaps even some of the members, know any of the successors well enough to know which direction it will take them, but they're going to have discussions about that between now and the election, I'm sure, in terms of the election for that position, I mean, and feel out the individuals on their various attitudes. But for the time being, John Boehner is still calling the majority of the shots as the head of the caucus.
And Congressman Paul Ryan said that he has no interest in taking up the post, but maybe with the seat being vacated, he is giving it a second look. Ed Filone, what do you foresee happening with the majority position?
Well, first of all, I think Paul Ryan is a very smart guy, and so I think he very rationally concludes that there is absolutely no benefit to him wading into the swamp that is the Republican leadership and trying to corral his colleagues. As John Boehner has found, it's an incredibly unfulfilling and frustrating role. The Republican Party right now nationally is united by one thing, and that is obstructing the Obama administration on every turn. But when it comes to presenting alternatives, an alternative version of national health care, an alternative to the immigration reform bill, an alternative on any policy issue, they can't even come to an agreement on an alternative. They can't put forth unity on any sort of policy front. All they can do is obstruct. And so I think you're going to change the faces in the leadership at the House, but it's going to be the same obstructionism without any real alternative that we've been seeing for the last 6 years here.
Margaret, what do you think that Congress will start working together a little bit better after the midterm elections, or do you predict much of the same?
Well, I think the polarization that we're seeing is caused by a lot of factors, and it's going to be it's going to be difficult, I think, to overcome it. You can say, you know, and I understand where Ed is coming from, saying obstruct at the same time. I don't think Harry Reid is the most lovable sit-down-and-deal-with-me person in the world to deal with, nor is Nancy Pelosi. It was their way or the highway when they had the majorities, and they didn't turn and ask for Republican involvement in developing things. If they had the votes, they just rammed things through, and Obamacare is the best example of that. There isn't a Republican who voted for it or was asked to be any part of the formulation of it. There have been, in both houses, other health care proposals brought forth. There have been other immigration proposals brought forth. But when you know you don't have a chance at all to have them have anything but to have them shot down, if not in the House, in the Senate. I mean, it's hard to get some assembly members, I mean, slipping to the local, I'm sorry, it's hard to get some House of Representative members to stick their neck out right now for something that they know doesn't have a chance to move anywhere in the Senate. They would rather use that vote wisely when it can constructively come to an end, that either the Senate would find ways to work with them and amend it and get it through, or even get down to the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue and get the president to sign it. He won't do it. So Ed's right that perhaps they're trying to obstruct, but that is also the case that the Democrats won't accept anything that the Republicans are doing either in the Senate or at the White House to have it signed into law. So we are polarized. Is it going to get better? I don't know. That calls for a lot of new leadership, a different tone of leadership on both sides, and I don't know if we could think that that's going to happen after the next election or not.
Real quickly, overseas, Islamic insurgents have taken control of some important cities in Iraq. President Obama says that Iraq will need assistance from the U.S. in some form to push back. Meanwhile, House Speaker John Boehner says Obama is, quote, taking a nap on Iraq and that U.S. progress there is in jeopardy. What, if anything, should the U.S. do about the violence in Iraq? Ed Falone.
Well, we need to ask ourselves two questions. First of all, we need to remind ourselves, why were we in Iraq in the first place? And if we don't have a good reason for going into Iraq, we need to recognize there was no good reason for going into Iraq. Secondly, we have to ask ourselves, why should we stay? These are the questions that never got asked in Vietnam, and unfortunately, these are the things that people tend to forget over the generations. The lesson of Vietnam was you don't stay in a war simply because you're afraid of leaving. If we completely abandon Iraq, to pull out all defense forces, all support, it may be that the insurgents win, and that may not be a good result. On the other hand, why were we there in the first place? And we shouldn't just stay to avoid pulling out. That's a quagmire.
And Margaret, in our last minute here, let me give you a chance to respond.
Well, I think that we've seen a lack in strategic thinking in our foreign policy, period, in this administration, and President Obama has not had answers for these. This is a very difficult issue. We cannot totally ignore Iraq. It is in the critical part of the world, and I think that when you look at the oil, 20% of the oil, at least in the world, is in within the Iraq boundaries. We can't ignore them, but the question of how we help them at this point is critical, and I'm very nervous about the handling of it by the White House.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, but first let's review the Week in Review quiz question. The Food and Drug Administration cheesed off a lot of Wisconsin cheesemakers. That's Bill Martin's words there, by the way. Before reversing its decision, what did the FDA say that cheesemakers could no longer use to age cheese? The answer was wooden boards, and we want to congratulate Mike in Bayview for having the correct answer there. He's our Week in Review quiz winner. Thank you, Margaret Farrow, for being with us today.
Well, it's good to be with you. Have a good weekend.
You too. Thanks, Ed Falone.
Thanks, Cynthia. Thanks, Margaret.
Ed Falone is an associate professor of law at Marquette University. Margaret Farrow, a former Republican lieutenant governor and former state lawmaker. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. This has been the Week in Review, produced by Bill Martins and Christy Taylor here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.